This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
Hi, this is Michael Dorn, Lieutenant Commander Worf from Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 217, Dr. T and his files. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Larry Nemechek. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including the passing of Alexander actor John Paul Stauer, Jonathan Frakes' comparison of the Discovery cast to that of The Next Generation, La La Land Records' Deep Space Nine Volume 2, and some big news from Trekland. Then in the feature, Larry and I look back at 25 years of Deep Space Nine. So let's step into the Ready Room. Well, Larry, look at this. I found a new orb, the Orb of History, and I opened it, and you popped out. How strange is that?
It's not. I'm pretty old, Chris. If there's anything, it's going to be historical. It's going to be me. No.
Well, it was specifically the Orb of Star Trek History, which I guess makes a little more sense.
Oh, okay. Is that from the eighth season that Ira and the writers did for the new documentary?
Yeah, it
That's
was.
That's the unknown orb. That's the lost orb, the Orb of Trek History. Yeah.
Exactly. All right. Well, I'm glad anyway that you popped out here in the Ready Room for another episode. The first one I've done in a while, but it's good to have you back.
It's good to have the Ready Room back, and it is good to be back here. I know we don't date the episodes, but it's a brand spanking shiny year, so here we go.
That's right. It has been a couple of months since we were here. And for the first time in a while, we are not going to be doing a Discovery episode. We're actually going to be talking about Deep Space Nine today, because January 3rd marked the 25th anniversary of the premiere of Emissary. And Larry, that was really hard for me to believe.
I know, but you know, if you're going to have an anniversary of Next Gen being 30, then I guess a 25th for DS9 is going to be right around the corner.
Larry Nemechek, the Vulcan, bringing your logic to anniversaries here.
You're one to talk about. No, it's hard to find a digit that doesn't have a Trek. I've kidded about that before. Every year is some kind of a Trek anniversary, right?
Yeah. Right? I know, right?
But no,
every day could be like the 25th anniversary of the filming or the airing or the script writing of this famous episode.
Chris, there are 47 websites out there now. That's all they do. On this day in 1997, the fourth day of the, you know, yes.
Exactly. All right. Well, we're going to talk about that as the feature. But before that, we have a few news items, Larry, including one announcement from you.
Yes. Very proud, finally.
I'll just tease it a little bit by saying that I have heard that the truth is out there. And then we'll come back to that. So before that, we are going to start on, unfortunately, a bit of a sad note.
Yes.
On January 1st, John Paul Stauer, who played young Alexander on The Next Generation, passed away, and he was only 33 years old. And it's always sad to see someone pass away at such a young age, to pass away in general. And at that age, especially, he had become known. I did not know this myself because I have not been keeping up with his career, but he had become known as Johnny P. Jules, playing in a Portland-based rock band called Problems.
Yeah, he'd been big on the punk scene. I guess he'd, I didn't, you know, he was a one-off child actor. but gone on and had a career in Denver, and then he moved to Portland punk. And then he'd also, with his parents helping out, had opened a vegan bakery eatery in Portland. If just going on the Portland stereotypes, this all sounds very Portlandish. But yeah, and so he had a whole community of people between his restaurant that his parents helped manage and his bands, and was apparently very, you know, beloved. And yeah, passed away. And anyway, one of my good fan friends, Philip Gilfus up in Seattle, sent me a note the night that he first died, before it really went wide. And I was tweeting about it that night. It was, what really struck me first was that people were going to confuse John with Brian Bonsall, who had a really troubled life. Right. And it was like, yeah, wow, yeah, what is it about, you know, playing war, you know, Alexander that
yeah.
that has been there? But no, apparently he had a good life, and apparently Brian Bonsall has, for lack of a better phrase, settled down and is doing better with himself. I was reading on that too. This got me down a whole little chain of like, well, I haven't checked into these people in a while. But yeah, it really shook up the local community. And there were even two, there was a GoFundMe and a Care Fund. There were two different drives. One was to help his parents out with the bills from the restaurant, and one was to help his friends do a meaningful memorial service and get people into town who wanted to come there. So, but yeah, it's, you know, he just was a kid actor, one off it for Star Trek, but the Star Trek world, you know, takes notice of its family. And that was, that was sad.
Yeah, it is sad. His band released a statement, which I'd like to read here just to honor him. They said, "It is with heavy hearts and saddened minds that we announce the passing of our dear friend and singer, Johnny Jules, aka John Paul Stauer. The addition of Johnny to our dysfunctional band family was one of the best choices that we have ever made, and he brought a much-needed sense of fun and lightheartedness to everything we did. He was only with us for a little more than a year, but we managed to cram a lifetime of great experiences into his tenure as our singer. Dozens of shows at home in Portland and across several states, an amazing European tour, and our best full-length release yet. We've lost our singer, but far, far more than that, we've lost a friend. Rest in peace, Johnny. We love you." So, yeah, again, very sad. We've gone through this thing. It's natural, right? Because with if you think about when television first began and then actors are becoming older, we're now in a time where we lose people very frequently. And it seems like, oh my God, we're losing this person and this person and this person. But of course, it's natural, time passes, but to die at 33 is just really a sad thing to see. So
right, and you know, he didn't continue to play Alexander, not from any fault of his, but they needed the care after the shock value of introducing him. That after they wanted to decide to bring the character back, they needed it to be a little bit more mature actor, and not like he was immature, but they needed to basically be older and come up with a whole, you know, the whole trope of, oh, well, the Klingons grow. It's the old TV kid thing. You see the baby's born, and then a year later, they're six. And at least on Star Trek, they were always seen to be intermixed aliens, whether it was Alexander or Naomi Wildman or whoever. Oh, look, they're just aging faster. Wasn't that just a year ago he was born? Yes, but, you know, Klingon human hybrids just grow up faster, I guess. And they went to Brian after that for that run of when they actually started to develop the character and needed him to be able... You know, a child actor, you can only do so much, and they're very rare. And how many child actors are a hit when they're younger, but then they decide by the time they grow out of being a cute kid, even if they're precocious and they can handle dialogue and taking direction, that acting is not for them. And this was the case with John. You know, by the time he was a teen, he was not acting anymore and went into music. So he's still performing. You know, the DNA is still there. And that happens to so many... You know, it's rare that you have a child actor. You know, we have the whole troubled child actor meme out there, on some degree of the spectrum. So, but he was having a good life, apparently, and that's too bad.
Yeah, so we send our condolences, of course, from the Ready Room and the network. And of course, we'll always be able to remember him, watching him on The Next Generation.
And maybe you could put the links up for those funds. Apparently, his parents were left... a little bit holding the bag on the restaurant as they decided what to do about it. So the local friends of his were putting out the two different funds.
Okay, we'll look for those links as well. So another new story. I said we're not going to talk about Discovery. This is tied into Discovery slightly. Jonathan Frakes, just before Despite Yourself aired, he did an interview and he mentioned that he felt that the Discovery cast was very much like the TNG cast in how they're mm-hmm. so close-knit. And the TNG cast is famously close to one another. I wanted to ask you, Larry, I don't want to talk so much about that story. What I want to ask you about is, what was it like for the casts of the other shows? Because over the years, you were able to spend time on the sets and interview many of the actors in DS9 and Voyager and Enterprise. And we all think about the TNG cast, and I think a little less, how did the cast of the other shows get together? So do you feel like the TNG cast was really unique in being so close-knit? How did it compare to the others?
I, as far as like a front row seat, it was late in the game, fifth, sixth season. So they were already, you know, wild and woolly and devilish and had already mm-hmm. run off one or two directors early on and had their own dynamic. But they were. And as much as we think about even the original series cast, but there was, you know, there was the Shatner, everybody else, the Shatner, Nimoy split off, then the Shatner and D. Kelly like on the fence, where D was good with everybody, you know, was open hearted to everybody, but he could occupy the triangle with, you know, mm-hmm. and the dynamics there. So no, they didn't all, they did to some degree a little bit, but they didn't hang out. The Next Gen cast, I think, kind of broke the mold as far as, yes, hanging out from top to bottom, not them against the world, but going through all that and
them against the quadrant.
Them there. Against the right. Far more than just a mere sector. Far more than 20 light years square. And then DS9, it's DS9's anniversary. We're talking about that. It was really a contrast to Next Gen. If you're talking about the casts, it's not that they didn't get along, but you had real individuals who had different goals. Like Avery was, I say this is all the love in the world. Avery was an odd bird at times. And if people have seen him mm-hmm. when he did a great live piano jazz concert one year to end the Vegas convention. And he, you know, he's an interesting guy and really, you know, wonderful. But he wasn't Patrick Stewart and he wasn't William Shatner and he wasn't Kate Mulgrew. I mean, And the DS9 cast had, for one thing, it felt larger because of all the recurring characters, you know.
Yeah.
Adjacent regulars like Andy, you know, Robinson and all the rest. But I think there were segments of them that were close, like there were pairs, twos and threes and all that. But no, I don't think they did not go out and party and dinner like the Next Gen cast did. And then the Voyager cast, Kate felt her responsibility as the first woman captain very strongly, and not that she didn't let her hair down, but that show, and Roxanne was kind of like the tomboy, so she got along with this, and I think Jennifer at times was sheltered and little lost, and then Jerry came in and was kind of the tomboy, you know, hangout. But Voyager, the guys were very, I mean, you'll see them now, they get together at least once a year, and there's like the six or seven mm-hmm. of them around the table. They're really close, and not that it was like Kate and the guys, or the girls and the guys, but they were just that way. And they talk about all the stunts and the fart jokes, everything on stage, and all of that stuff was all of them while they're filming. That was them. And so they were really close in that dynamic. And then the Enterprise cast, in a lot of ways, since Scott was the known actor and almost all the rest, and then John Billingsley was the longest resumed working actor. You know, he'd been around the band. He and Scott probably had the most just pure experience. And Dominic had too, but he was in the UK. So they, you know, kind of like Terry on DS9, Jolene had been a model and, mm-hmm. you know, into acting. So they were kind of getting their acting chops and kind of studying up and coaching up and all that. But Enterprise had their moments and the guys together. And, you know, but it was kind of like dyads and triads of people on Enterprise. So, you know, of all of the casts, the closest I would say that I put Next Gen ahead of the original series, even though the convention scene later on kind of brought them all together. That's happened with all the casts. But in the moment, I think the guys on Voyager as a unit and the closest thing to a full cast, we're probably the closest go hang out dinner thing to the Next Gen cast. That's what, and a lot of people, mm-hmm. you know, Marina and a lot of people would say, well, that's because Gene chose us, you know, or some, there was some, not to be snooty, but there was something intangible going on there or something. Who, you know.
Yeah. Well, they were charting new territory in a sense, right? Like no one thought right. this could succeed. And so they were in it together. And every cast that came after had the built-in success of Star Trek. And they were the next chapter in it as opposed to them
right.
being...
Right.
I, that sounds a little bit weird. You know, I'm not saying the original wasn't successful and then we did have the TOS movies, but it's just, there was such a gap.
No. Fame, cult, fandom, genre fame before any of this was invented. You know, you had, like we said many times, you had singers, musicians, and bands, and maybe you had maybe a franchise like James Bond or, you know, I don't know, what do you compare it to? Elvis Presley movies? I mean, what do you compare this to? But Star Trek broke that mold and really caught all the cast, all of them in their own ways. And the little five or whatever were really caught up by it, about being stereotyped and being caught up in the fame.
Yeah.
But not being remunerated for it. You know?
Right.
And then Next Gen, everybody thought, this is crazy. It's a sci-fi syndicated show. No one thought it would go more than a year. So yes, DS9 had this feeling that we're riding a wave. But, you know, the DS9 people were all independent. Like, Colm was like, I want to be able to do movies. You know?
Right.
And I think Avery was like, this is not going to define... A lot of them were like, this is not defining my career. You know, I think all of them to a degree were very insistent on, this is great, but I just want to be able to, this will not be the only thing I do. It was odd.
Well, I think that's kind of a concern for an actor going into a franchise sure. like Star Trek in particular, right?
Well, when they haven't
because
been known
the notoriety.
For anything, that's the other thing. If they're known yeah. for something already, it's easier to right. have that buff, that comfort zone.
Yeah, right. All right. Well, that's interesting. Interesting to see how all the casts compare.
But yes, we've got to bring it back around Discovery and Frakes. I don't know how you could have been alive in 2016 and not in 2017 and not seen Instagram and Twitter pic, you know, day after day of that cast all hanging out yeah. together in Toronto
yeah.
while they fought. And it was great. It was great to see. It was a whole new dynamic for Star Trek and its fans. And I think there were a couple of times when it caught the CBS PR machine off guard a little bit. So I think they had to learn the new rules that weren't spoilerific. You know, in the morning when I've gone blank on his name that played Takuvma, did his Instagram movies was they were all in the van at 4 a.m. in the morning going in for makeup. They were giving away like who had been cast almost by he was showing who was in the van with him. And that was an interesting moment. But
I could just see a photo like, hey, we've all gone out for steaks with Takuvma to make him feel better after his character was killed today on the set.
CBS the lead.
CBS is like, that's a little bit of a spoiler, guys. Maybe you want to take that off your Instagram.
Well, yes. And you're being very upbeat there as you were impersonating the voice from CBS. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's go on to the next story, which is about Deep Space Nine. And La La Land Records has released the second volume of the Deep Space Nine music collection. I have the first volume right over here on my shelf and also in my computer, so I can listen to it on my phone and my iPad. And it is fantastic. Volume 1 was released in 2013. And now we get Volume 2 just in time for the 25th anniversary. And this has more than 100 tracks. Has music from Dennis McCarthy, Jay Chataway, David Bell, Paul Bilargin, and Gregory Smith. And the number of episodes that the music is from is quite extensive. We have music from Culess, Battle Lines, Melora, The Wire, The Jem'Hadar, Past Tense, Hard Time for the Uniform, Blaze of Glory, A Time to Stand, Extreme Measures, Past Prologue. I'm going to catch my breath here and give you time to absorb that. And then tell you that Rumpelstiltskin is coming from If Wishes Were Horses. Also, Cardassians, The Maquis, Family Business, Rejoined, Tears of the Prophets, The Quickening, Treachery, Faith, and the Great River, Till Death Do Us Part, The Dogs of War, Shakar, The Muse, When It Rains, Honor Among Thieves, Through the Looking Glass, Bada Bing Bada Bang, His Way, Looking for Parmak in All the Wrong Places, Let He Who Is Without Sin Waltz, and The Muse. So quite a rundown there. See how extensive this collection is.
I was glad to hear, and I'm going to profess I'm not up to date with the first chapter, the first volume of music. So I hope that one of these two, I heard Bada Bing Bada Bang. I don't know what it is about DS9, but my mind, I said this before, I know over the years at some point, but my mind always goes to the offbeat shows first, and it shouldn't. But, you know, just the homages and the film bits from like Little Green Men and Our Man Bashir, especially Our Man Bashir, because supposedly they had a little pushback from the James Bond franchise about the John Barry-ish trumpets.
Yeah.
So has Our Man Bashir been in either one of these sets? You didn't mention it here.
Yeah, actually, Larry, on Volume 1, they did Our Man Bashir. On Disc 2 and 4, Disc 2 had the cues. And I haven't listened to it in a while, so it might be the trumpets you're talking about. I know the fourth disc has more extensive music. It's got, I think, 5 or 6 tracks from Our Man Bashir.
Uh-huh. Okay. Tribulations and or... 'cause now I'm sitting here trying to remember what the music in Tribulations was like and the Little Green Men music. And hopefully they did something fun with it. But anyway.
Yeah, Tribulations is also on the same disc with Our Man Bashir in there. And they have Little Green Men also, only just a little bit of music from there.
Okay. Well, that answered my question. Okay.
So these collections, they're not comprehensive in the sense that it isn't every single note that you heard in every episode.
Well, 7 years.
They are really, really nice collections, though.
And far more comprehensive than anything that's been...
Yeah, all the key music that you would be thinking of from the episodes usually on there. It's a 4-disc set. And as I mentioned, more than 100 tracks. They're only making 3,000 units. And my recollection with Volume 1 is that, you know, it didn't fly off the shelf. You could still get it for
quite a while. I barely remember even hearing it mentioned in circles. So, yeah, that's...
But they do eventually sell out of these things. So if you want one, I do recommend that you order it. It's $60 for Volume 2. And they do a promotional thing. I recall them doing this as well with Volume 1. If you're one of the first 200 people to purchase through La La Land Records, I guess through their website, then you get a signed front tray card by Dennis McCarthy. So you get a little perk.
Very nice.
I have not ordered mine yet. I'm planning to do it this weekend. So I don't know yet if I'll be one of those first 200. My guess is I won't be, but I think I'll be safe to be one of those first 3,000 though.
Yeah. Okay.
So yeah, you know, as a musician, I think most everyone who listens to this show at this point after 7 years knows that I'm a classical musician. I play bass trombone. I went to music conservatory. And I also went to music school at university and played professionally for 7 years. So I'm very steeped in this kind of music from a performance standpoint. And I just love these collections. And I'm glad that there's someone like La La Land Records who actually takes the time to preserve this and put it on collections, because otherwise it would be really easy for this stuff to get lost. And also, I've noticed that most of the Star Trek soundtracks, I have them on physical CD, and I bought them right after the movie, right at the time the movie was in the theater. And what I've noticed is that I have them ripped into my computer, but now I use Apple Music. And so it kind of like, it knows what's in your collection, and it serves you up the tracks based on what it has. And I am increasingly finding that some tracks get confused, or in the case of First Contact, for example, the Steppenwolf and the Roy Orbison stuff isn't on there anymore. So you need to have gotten the actual physical disc at the time in order to have that. So I do recommend, even though I buy most of my music digitally these days, this is the kind of stuff that I still like to get on physical disc.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'm glad that my one-off... My one-off episodes have already been out there, and
Yep, it's all there for you, Larry.
Okay, as long as it's all about me, so okay.
And again, if you want that, just go to lalalandrecords.com, and you'll see it right up there on the front page. And we don't get anything for you ordering it, but I'm just letting you know it's there as we talk about DS9 today.
And not that apparently the numbers are going to be huge, but in the overall, you know, cosmic karmic campaign to get the damn DS9s, you know, Blu-rayed and remastered, seeing the soundtracks, if not fly off the shelves, at least sell out, would be another good nudge to watch, you know, the number needle moving.
If nothing else, maybe we can get better audio quality on those Netflix episodes, Larry. When they see that, they'll go, we can't remaster the whole series, but we're going to do the audio. We're going to do it in like 12.1 Dolby surround or something like that.
I don't know. Yeah, that's the
ticket. Can you imagine if on the promenade, you know, like in your living room, you put speakers up on the ceiling so you've got surround sound. What if they had that all the way around the promenade? So when Cisco's talking to Dekat on the view screen or something, Dekat's voice just sounds as good as possible.
Oh, I was just thinking about people like walking left to right on the, you know, you're in Quarks and at the window and you see people walking by and you actually get, you know, surrounded.
Oh, yeah.
Left to right crosses. I actually. Or people running, you know, security guards are chasing somebody and you actually hear
exactly.
The Doppler goes left to right or something wacky, you know.
I actually was, I was saying promenade, but I was picturing ops. So I think they should do both, though. And I think Quark should personally pay for the system on the promenade because he would benefit from it most.
I think so, too. Yes, the audio experience at Quark's is just to die for. Yeah, that's a real big selling point. Yeah.
Okay, well, let's move on to the last news item. And Larry, I said at the beginning of the show that I have heard that the truth is out there, at least the Star Trek truth is out there. I understand there's something called the Trek files.
Are you talking about the T files? Is that what you're talking about?
The T files. That's right. Yes. The T files.
Well,
what are the T files or the Trek files?
Well, the Trek files is, I mean, I've said for years that I would not do my own podcast. Now, I've been doing a little thing weekly on Facebook for the last 6-8 months. Called Trekland Tuesdays Live, which I invite everybody to go over and find. 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 Eastern, whatever, 8 or 9 at night on the European continent.
Sometime in Asia.
Sometime in Asia. Yeah, one of those. Other side of the dateline. Who knows? Who knows what you people live on? But that's just on Facebook Live. It's a little 10, 15-minute live bit of me in the archives are up at my Trekland Facebook page. But as far as an actual, you know, a God's honest truth podcast here, I didn't want to do one unless I was bringing something new to it or et cetera, because there were so many good ones. You know, that's why I've enjoyed being a guest on the Trek FMs over the years. A lot of other good ones out there too. But I had an offer that I could not refuse when, you know, John Champion, who, as you all know, co-hosts on Mission Log, and that's under the Roddenberry banner, when they opted to add a few, you know, expand a network, not a huge, not giant killing network, but start adding a couple more shows and doing some expanded things that were germane to their assets, at you know, what Rod has inherited from the family. One of those was a desire, and especially after they got into another round of donating archives to the UCLA library, getting into exactly how many, you know, documents and archives and files there still are from Gene and from the company and back and forth and things written to Gene that he responded to. And, you know, everything from formal projects that we know well about to things that didn't happen, like the 70s movies and all the iterations. Mm-hmm. To just correspondence back and forth between Gene and fans or Gene and other celebrities, Gene in the office. So, you know, Rod and John came to me and said, we want to do something with this in a podcast form. We'd like you to do it, Dr. Trek, which I was very tickled they did that. So
Dr. T.
Dr. T,
mean, right?
Yes, yes. Dr. T and his files. That I feel like... feel like I should have been a segment
like
on
a good name for a band, Larry.
I was thinking it was a segment on, you know, on Underdog or something. Anyway, that I should introduce a thing like Commander McBragg. Oh, I'm sorry, guys. I'm deep diving that one, boy. but no, so it was really a lot of fun. And so we have pulled all kinds of documents out of the files. A couple of things aren't so, I mean, basically the log line of the show is it's a look into the archives of Roddenberry Entertainment from the personal files of Gene Roddenberry. We've been working on this since the idea came out in the spring. We've been working on it since the summer. We announced it. with little fanfare, but we did announce it at Comic-Con San Diego last year. I put together a podcasters panel, had people from, you know, had Kayla from Trek Movie and Aaron from Trek FM, Aaron Harvey, and myself, and now I'm, and John, and I'm probably leaving somebody out, and now I'm going to get in trouble. But at the time, we also used that to announce the Trek Files, and Aaron did the logo for us. Maybe we can put that up. And the only question was, how fast would we do it? It's a 15-minute, and I know people are out there gasping and giggling that I can be limited to 15 minutes, but that's what we do. The format is we pull out a document of some kind, and if it's a lengthy document, we at least focus on one part to kick off with. Part of the document's highlighted. Every week, this is a weekly 15-minute podcast, and every week the document in question is available to view and download and look at. It's watermarked, but it'll be on – we're using Facebook as a hub, so every week you would go to facebook.com/thetrekfiles, and ahead of time you can see the day of dropping, which is going to be midnight or 12:01 a.m. on Tuesdays. So you can go look at the document, and then you can listen to us talk about it. Now, I say us because I'm the host, and every show I have a guest. John has been a guest, and the first cycle of guests, I've done 3 or 4 shows with each one. John has been a guest, and Dave Rossi has been a guest on some early shows, and somebody you may have heard of, Dorothy Fontana, is a guest with me, talking about 60s and 70s and 80s. Memos, and there is at least one in this collection of the first, you know, few episodes that is going to make history. We will have news headlines, I predict. So we found something that I fell off my chair. A lot of this stuff is just really cool and interesting, and Trek nerds and Trek historians will enjoy getting into. We found memos about the 70s movies back and forth, and all the iterations, and the, you know, the wannabe projects that didn't happen. But there is one thing that I was shocked. I had no clue it existed. We have one document, Chris. I guarantee it will make headlines. It will make headlines in the Trek press. Maybe we'll even leap over into the mainstream genre world too. But we have one wonderful document from the 80s, I should say. Gene died in 91. So there you go.
I see. It's the one about how originally in Star Trek IV, they had to go back to Earth and save a tardigrade, right?
Right. Damn it!
I'm sorry.
See, I thought...
I know you told me not to say anything.
Just cut that out.
Just too...
Just edit that out.
I'm sorry.
Help I'll preserve some integrity here. I'm trying to get this off the ground, Chris. Come on. Jeez.
All right.
The tardy. Yeah. Tardy and Grady. Those were the two... This is the name.
Tardy and Grady.
Yeah. So... But what am I doing? I should shut up. Yeah.
Grady is pregnant. How do you know that? Only Grady knows that.
Exactly. Boy, I thought we had something really obscure here. Damn. No, I'm really excited about this. So this technically was not my idea, but I immediately globbed onto it. And one thing that I've said about doing my own podcast was I didn't want to do, you know, I'm very much about not piling on and not doing the same old, and it's the nature of the beast, but I've from day one have railed about the internet being so incestuous. You know, one source comes up, or gal, comes up with a great story or an artifact, and 92 other things, you know, have to come in and do their own story and link to it. So I didn't want to just pile on the pile. So when we're pulling items out of Gene's files, this is something that's not duplicating anywhere. So that was one thing I was thrilled to do. And it's another chance to do, you know, to bring so what I do, you know, is try to bring context. But it's a lot of fun pulling these things out. And some of them are just for fun. We have some drafts that are things that are actually out in public, but it's like Gene's notes on when he would do like a chapter in a book or a foreword for something or letters from a celebrity. But also, and we actually have 2 or 3 bits, and I will say this, that are one very famous founding document of Star Trek that has been out in public for ages. But it's good to just start with, Rod wanted us to start with that. And, a couple of foundational tenets of Star Trek, and just get back into the context of what it meant. And again, we're like physically into files, and some of these things are on the paper. You know, it's paper that has Gene's handwriting on it, or it's something Gene sent to somebody, to Dorothy, or to David Gerald, or to somebody, and it's their original writing back and forth.
Cool.
Or so those are, so as much as we can't transcend that over the audio podcast, but you can, we'll have the scans on our Facebook page that people can, you know, each week you can go look at the document we're talking about. There are a couple of them that are so large we've broken them into multi parts. So you know, I don't want to just, we won't waste a perfectly good item to wade through.
When you do part two, do you say things like, previously on the Trek Files, yes, we were reading from this memo?
Jeez, Chris, I told you.
And then you read like one sentence from it.
Stop giving it all away. No, we a lot of the documents, we pull out something to focus on, but then we'll still talk about the whole piece. We'll just have a focus point because we want to bring it to life a little bit. So we have an interpreter reading. It's a little bit like a Ken Burns thing where you we're not panning across, but you've just got it. You've just got it there to see. And hopefully some of the excitement that we had finding these things, even though it's a scan and you're looking at it, but it's exciting. It's like, it's the next best thing to, you know, having Gene there to do a do the Orb of Time or Slingshot or whatever your preferred choice is of time travel, and going back and sitting in the office like you're going through old boxes and pulling things out, which is literally what we were doing. And the icing on the cake in going through all these documents and these files is when you find something that is so relevant to today. We found one document that totally kicked into something that had happened on Discovery, a line of dialogue. And yeah, that's just the cherry on top. We like to think of Gene's writing as relevant and timeless to our times, if not the franchise itself. And I said, oh my gosh, we've got to pull this out and tie it right into Discovery when we do that. So that's another, that's been another fun byproduct of this whole process and this whole Discovery. No pun intended. We've got several shows recorded. The guests kind of rotate in and out on different topics. I'll have another galley of guests after the first, you know, batch of shows. So January 23rd is our premiere date for episode one for the Trek Files. I'm so thrilled to finally be able to say that. And then that's a Tuesday. So at midnight at 12:01 Tuesday, the document will be at our Facebook page where you can look at it. And the podcast will be there. So every week. And again, it's 15 minutes. I swear to God, Chris, I swear to God, 15 minutes, really. John is keeping me honest. Yes.
This I have to see.
I know.
Or hear.
And here.
So I will also mention again, this is officially part of the Roddenberry Podcast Network, but it will also be available in the Trek FM Master Feed, just yes, as Mission Log is. It will also be available through the Trek FM Artist page in Apple Podcasts and iTunes, just as Mission Log and Mission Log Live both are. So you'll be able to find it there as well. And again, if you subscribe to the Master Feed, you'll be getting it every Tuesday.
So, anyway. So thank you for being a co-host as we launch this. I will see. 15 minutes should be bite-sized pieces for everybody. But having the document there on Facebook will be, some of them are multi-page. It's not just like bang. Some of them are simpler. Some of them are more complex, but they're all fun. So Rod is executive producer. Ken Ray, John's co-host, is doing production on them. And so, yeah, the Facebook page, which should be operational by the time people are hearing this, is facebook.com, The Trek Files. That's pretty easy. Like I think I mentioned, our good friend Aaron Harvey did the logo for The Trek Files, which if you were looking at some of the coverage from Comic-Con we had last July, so that's been in hand. And, podcast.roddenberry.com is, the native home. But, yeah, it'll be here in the Trek FM feed. So good for all the Trek FM subscribers. Yay.
And Larry, I do hope that the watermark on the documents is your head as you use on your banners and like the top of your website, you know, that photo
the
of
big
you
God
with your head kind of
yeah,
tilted. Yeah, I hope that's the watermark on all the documents.
Well, people don't
and
know
if
that
not, you need to redo them all before you launch.
People don't know that I was the runner up to do the god alien in Star Trek V. So it's just haunting me.
I see. Well, it sounds interesting, and I think that fans will really be interested in it. Fans are always eager to hear Dr. Trek talk about things, so this should be a very fascinating, as Spock would say, for everyone out there.
Thank you. And I should do a shout out to Eagle Moss, who actually sponsored the first few episodes. We'll see how that goes too. But yeah, a lot of fun. And one week is absolutely going to make news, I guarantee. So I'm very excited about that.
So I see Justin Wilson, the Cajun chef, is also a guest.
You picked up on that.
On the Trek Files. Did you guys have a little extra wine while you were
doing that? You know that wine is good for more than just drinking. Or what did he say? It's more good for more than just cooking with. Yeah, whatever. Onions.
We just put one spoon of wine in there, and then the bottle just keeps pouring while it's a spoon in. Yeah.
Anyway, thank you for letting me. Thank you for letting me get everybody braced for that. I'm just so excited. So yeah, January 23rd, everybody, check your Trek FM feed and check everywhere. We'll be there. And again, I think by now the page is up. The Facebook page is facebook.com. You know, the Trek Files on Facebook. Go and like it, obviously, and stay tuned.
So Larry, earlier this month on January 3rd, we marked the 25th anniversary of the premiere of Deep Space Nine.
Wait, what? What?
I know, that was my reaction too when I realized it was happening, because I thought back to where I was at the time, not only where I was in my life, but where I am now, and that much time has gone by.
I did a spit take on my Diet Coke Splenda. What?
Well, see, now there's a difference, Larry. Back then, you were definitely still popping open cans of Diet Coke, but they weren't sweetened with Splenda yet.
That's
right?
True. That's true. If I wasn't having a diet,
so things do change a little bit.
Things have changed. we'll get into this, but I think, I don't know what series things have changed, quote unquote, as much as they've changed for DS9.
In terms of fan perception?
In terms of fan perception, mainstream perception, and then yet the more things change, the more they stay the same. But I think the bottom line story about DS9, as we do a token stop on an anniversary and look at it closely, is about how the perception of DS9 changed, and how on some levels it was just like every other show, every other iteration of Star Trek, and on some levels it wasn't. But the bottom line being what the judgment of history is. And you know, and apparently I've seen fans actually talk about the Larry pendulum theory, so I guess it's a thing, but about how, you know, just the change of time, we view everything, you know, our changing filters and our changing perceptions. So, but I think that's the thing that strikes me the most about, aside from getting in and, you know, uber analyzing all the episodes and the arcs and all that, and telling production stories and unearthing and archiving things. But in the real here and now, the thing that strikes me on the 20th anniversary of DS9 is how far it's come. Even when it wasn't being made, you know, it was just sitting there on the shelf being itself. And we have changed around it, and the world has changed around it. But maybe I'm getting
and
ahead
yet
of
it
things.
Seems so applicable to our world. So, yeah, we'll get to that as we go along. Real quick, you mentioned the Larry pendulum theory. So I just want to tell people that if you haven't been listening to The Ready Room since early on, go all the way back to The Ready Room 19. That's when Larry and I talked about the Star Trek pendulum theory. Now, that wasn't the first time that Larry had ever talked about it, but we made that the focus of The Ready Room 19. That was October 16th, 2011.
Did you just, Larry. Do you have like etched in your brain? You're not like looking at anything. I'm watching the picture here. You're not looking at anything. I don't know if I should be honored or scared, Chris, that you that you did that.
But yeah, October 16th, 2011. So 6.5 years ago almost is when we did that episode, the Star Trek Pendulum. So go listen to that and you'll hear everything that Larry's talking about.
Well, and we were very much in the middle of the fallow times, the fallow years, and had no clue when we'd have series Trek back, and we, you know, still debating the merits of JJ movies, and is this all there is, and all of that. And yeah, there's something about doing a podcast that you say it out loud, and now I think it's even more than writing it, even though, you know, everything is online and things are archived for forever, the Wayback Machine and whatever. But there's something about it's. It just makes me laugh. I've had people, you know.
I think.
Well, Larry, I've heard your pendulum. I've listened to the Trek FM podcast, and I've heard your pendulum theory. Yeah. And I went, oh, I thought that was just common sense. I didn't know I get my own theory, but okay, sure, I'll go with it.
I think the thing about podcasts compared to writing it down on a blog or mm-hmm. even a news website, even like StarTrek.com, is that I think we're able to build more of a conversation around podcasts than we are right. articles or blog posts. Which is why those things catch on a little bit more.
And when
that's
you,
been
and
my
you,
experience and you hear, over 7 years.
Yes, and you hear the, I guess it personalizes it to hear the yeah. creator's voice rather than just reading
it does.
Black bits on white
I'm
bits.
Sure this happens to you, I'm sure, but people tweet at me sometimes and they say, you know, when I read your tweets, I read them in your voice because they're accustomed to hearing me speak rather than just reading my ideas.
It does
personalize it a bit.
I don't think I've heard that. Maybe I should just wait for somebody to come at me about the other side of the tweet or something sometime, and
maybe
that would
so.
Be a little weird. Yeah.
Okay. But so in talking about DS9, so we'll talk about, you know, where it is today as we go along here, but let's start with the development. Let's go back to 1992. The show is in development. We're hearing about it a bit in the news. There's this new Star Trek series coming up. What do you remember about that time?
Well, right. It was like Next Gen, you know, best of both worlds summer happens. So they go into fourth season, fifth season. The ratings are going up 10%, 20%, 30%. Next Gen is this phenomenon. And aside from, you know, people kind of remembering the show that was only going to last one season, and now you've got this huge hit that is relegating. I mean, literally, there was a time when, you know, Jimmy Doohan and Nichelle and George and Walter, I know this is amazing, folks, but I mean, if not for the resurrection as the Fab Four tour that they went out and did, there was a time when no one could, I mean, they were not attracting people to conventions. Next Gen was such the rage. The original series was almost being swept under the rug. It was old hat. And, you know, the force of the new was just everywhere. And part of that was, it's Hollywood. You got to have a spinoff, right? So what that would be, and you know, it's out there now, the research and the documentation about how, obviously, Paramount said, hey, Rick, let's make some more money on this and spread that. And then Rick and Michael Piller, who at the time were the head honchos of the franchise, and wondering what that would look like. And, you know, Mike handing off things to Jerry Taylor more and more to run Next Gen while they worked on developing this for a couple of years and what it would be, and Kerry McCluggage jumping in and saying, what about a Dodge City in space? Because every iteration of Star Trek, the first question is, we want something exactly like what's hot now, except different, right? Every movie, every series, yeah. every everything. So, and this was the first, you know, the paradigm had been shifted. The hoop had been jumped through with Next Gen. Oh my God, you're coming back after 30 years, the aging original cast. What does a new TV show look like? Do you recast, reboot? So they'd already formed that. We're in the same timeline. We're just 80 years down. So that had already been fostered. I mean, I remember thinking at the time, and I thought this for years, and I said it at the time, so you Enterprise naysayers, just leave. But I had said for ages, especially after I heard the Next Generation writers bemoaning how hard it was, not the ones that stuck, they got it, but how hard it was for outside writers, Emmy-winning, Oscar-winning writers to be able to play in Gene's sandbox with his rules about everybody mostly gets along, you know, the conflict yeah. and all of that. And me thinking, too bad, why don't we do a, you know, me thinking about expanding the canon and expanding the background that I loved and the gap filling is like, go back and do a founding of the Federation. I mean, I was all about Enterprise years before the background anyway. But
you
I
were
knew
Enterprise when Enterprise wasn't cool.
Yes, I was. I don't yeah. know if I would have used that name, but yes. But the point was, in the reality of Hollywood, they had invested in these sets and these costumes and these props. And that was what was so revolutionary about Brian's original idea about doing an anthology series with Discovery, and each season would hop to a different era. You can do that now. That's the trendy, windy thing to do. But back in the day when people are just counting pennies, and back when Next Gen started, you know, like again, it was going to be the 1 year flop, and before it became the, you know, the Wunderkind, and not only inspired more Star Treks, but inspired a whole slew of, you know, the revival of genre as sci-fi that I wrote a piece one time for Star.com talking about the Star Trek success is the Marvel superhero movies. That started a revolution that rippled out to the point where we have, you know, we have the Big Bang generation now, and the geeks won, and the revolution started with Next Gen. But at the time, you know, they wound up competing with themselves, and they wound up competing with all these things they had inspired. But it was pretty obvious that a sequel to Next Gen was going to be in the same era. I just could not see them jumping out to spend money to do a whole new set of costumes and props and set pieces when they had all this amortized they could pull from. And also, there were a lot of characters, as we saw early in DS9, from the Duras sisters on down, Gowron, I mean, go down the list, crossover people. And the first couple of years when Next Gen and DS9 were on the air together, you know, Bashir on Next Gen and bringing O'Brien over to DS9, and, you know, would have been Ensign Ro, but it wound up being Kira as a Bajoran character. But all of those things would have been lost had they gone somewhere else. So having the sequel series being set pretty much concurrent to the existing hit was pretty much a given, even though I personally would have loved to have seen them jump into something else. But again, the finances, the monetary situation was just going to call it that way, at least for the first. Now, if they start spinning these out every other year, like they kind of started to, then maybe something different. And then, but they're, you know, with Voyager, the whole thing of being crazy different was to go to another part of the galaxy. But still, it was all, we can still wear the black jumpsuits. We can still have our phasers look basically the same. You know, our tricorders look the same. So, but that was driving all of that at the beginning. And then, so that was the same. The different part was the Dodge City aspect.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, how did you feel about that as a lifelong Star Trek fan? You hear people, even today, I still hear people sometimes say, oh, I don't like Deep Space Nine because that show doesn't go anywhere. And then I know that, well, they didn't watch the show because they would know that soon they got the Defiant and then the storyline went all over the place. But you, just the original setup, I mean, how did you feel about the idea of having a stationary Star Trek versus a ship that explored from planet to planet?
If you heard that today from someone, you knew they had to be an old timer, because no one says that now. I think if people sit down and watch DS9 for real for the first time, no one jumps up from it after. I'm not laughing at you. I'm saying nobody, the perspective of people sitting down to watch it fresh now, no one goes, this show doesn't go anywhere. That's not.
Sure.
You know.
No, these are definitely old timers who have been sitting on that line since 1993, and they're still repeating that line, and they've still never actually watched the show. But you don't hear that. Like you're saying, of course, someone new watching it today probably wouldn't feel that way. And most fans at this point have at least watched some and have learned that, well, yeah, DS9 evolved over the course of 7 years.
Well, so, you know, we talk about the premiere here in January 93, but obviously it had been in, for a year, year and a half, it had been in R&D, first like the brainchild on paper, and then put down and then brought to life production-wise and then shot. Starting in the summer, you know, the emissary was, and so it was a secret, but it was increasingly less under wraps as it came to life, right? And so, since early '92, I was lucky enough to get the contract to do the companion for Next Generation. Went out for a week to L.A. when DS9 was still very, very secret, and my first glimpse of DS9 was knowing that they were working on it. And, you know, like the script was being passed around in unmarked envelopes between the offices, and I'd kind of see it go by, but I was not in a place to do that. As we got the next, and then I came back to Oklahoma, and, you know, then they were filming in the summer. I was pre-internet. We're getting little bits and bobs in Starlog, in the mainstream media, the entertainment press, little bits in TV Guide or something or whatever. I think Entertainment Weekly was a thing then, the weekly magazine.
Yeah, and Entertainment Tonight on television.
Yes, and Entertainment Tonight on television was the other major thing. And everybody, you know, setting their VCRs to keep the clips. and analyze them.
Yeah, the theme song just went off in my head right now.
Da 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 da.
Exactly.
Yes. Tell us, Mary, what do we got on? Yeah. And John, Mary and John. Not knowing he had, by then he'd been a Klingon. John Tesh.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Season two. But anyway, what's my memory though, thinking back, is remembering DS9 being a secret. And I don't want to say I wasn't excited for it. I was curious. Maybe part of this was because I had this huge project in my lap that I was under the gun to get done.
Yeah.
But I just remember it happening, not getting a sneak peek at anything on the lot when I was, well, they weren't filmed. They weren't anywhere near that far along in the spring of 92. And then when I went back in 93, by the time a year had gone by, they had filmed, they'd premiered, and it was out. And when I talked to Ira for the first time, it was after the first year had gone down of DS9. I was talking to him as a add-on to do the next edition of the Next Gen Companion about, you know, about Vosh and his creator and all of his TNG shows and the crazy third season and all that stuff. But we did talk about DS9 a little bit. And Peter Allen Field, Pete Fields, who had worked on Next Gen, who was the token Loxana Troy writer, whenever... After his first one, whenever they had to do a Loxana, they always would yank him back to do a Next Gen Loxana. But he was working the first season of DS9 too. So you were picking all that up and it was out invisible by then. But I even sitting back home in Oklahoma and having a foot in the Trek world officially, and then also being consumer of media, it was exciting. It was obvious that Next Generation had been such a hit that it provided this. It's the Hollywood formula. Here's the spinoff. And I remember being excited about it. And I also remember being excited locally because they were both syndicated and stupid Next Generation was stuck with our NBC affiliate. I've said this before, 10:30 Sunday night, all 7 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. You've heard me talk about this. They tried it one time on the part two of Best of Both Worlds. They didn't announce it. People called in furious that they had missed the conclusion to Best of Both Worlds, and they moved it back to 10. They had it at like 7 or 8 o'clock on Friday night, and then they moved it back to 10:30 Sunday. And also years of the – it was NFL, the NBC affiliate. So all of the AFC games, if they ran long, people had to learn how to leave their VCRs wide open for taping. But DS9 out of the gate was on our local Fox station, which just as a fan, and we were trying to do conventions, all of a sudden we went from the NBC affiliate – thrilled to have ratings at 10:30 Sunday to an upstart Fox affiliate, thrilled to have a Star Trek to promote. And they would jump in and co-promote things at our conventions. And, you know, I mean, just on a weird little way, the dimension of DS9 was so different. I had my DS9 premiere VHS tape that I was on the press list and got sent to me in Oklahoma. So I had a tape of Emissary in the little preview, thing beforehand. And the other odd thing was for about 3 or 4 months, I was getting preview materials for DS9. And I think I showed you, I have the writer's in-house technical manual dated for October 4th, 1992, which was, the Next Generation ones are very storied, but this was the Bible, the typed Bible that they did dated September 10th. And then the front was actually Mike and Rick doing a TNG style tech guide about the station and everything being so Cardassian and what's different and, what are all the story springboards from how the station works and how it's laid out. It's not a starship, but Ops is still at the top. Go figure.
Of course. Put it in the most vulnerable position.
Right. Because it works well for the Federation. But my overall memory of that time was just going, oh, it's more Star Trek. I'm trying to remember when the phrase darker, grittier became like this meme that was just almost trite, oh, it's the darker, grittier. And they said that. And then there came a point where they pushed back. Well, no, it's not necessarily the darker, grittier. Everybody says that. Well, everybody says that because you started saying that, Paramount. And, they were trying to different. It's it's the same, but it's different. And how is it different? And how is it the same? And that's the creation puzzle. And that's the promotional puzzle that any Star Trek has.
Right. I kind of feel memory could be wrong, but I kind of feel that darker, grittier line was the kind of thing you would hear on Entertainment Tonight. you know, to play up this new Star Trek series. Mm-hmm. It's darker and grittier. But yeah, I heard darker and grittier all the time. And it stuck with me for a long time, thinking, oh, well, yeah, this is the darker, grittier Star Trek. Of course, when I look at it today, I don't feel that way. I feel like, well, it's a different take on Star Trek, but it's not what I would call dark or gritty or dystopian or anything along those lines.
Well, the memes that we have now that we've played with and happened fairly soon, I need to go back and look at media and zines and coverage from like 92 and 93, because that, you know, again, Next Generation was at its zenith. It was the froth. It was driving. And we knew, you know, by 93, they announced that they were going into a, you know, it's going to be the movie. We are definitely doing a Next Gen movie. And it was, oh, yeah. Are we just in a formula? And are these guys being cast for DS9 going to have a guaranteed 2 or 3 or 4 movie? You know, is every Star Trek series from now just going to be guaranteed a movie, which is what the fans were assuming. But, you know, the bean counters say differently. It's, you've still got to earn it. But it was in a very, Next Gen could do no wrong. It was, you know, a lot of people will say the 7th season was not as good as the 6th. The 6th wasn't quite as good as, you know, the 5th. They were maybe getting a little gassed on the end of Next Gen. And what's also funny to me is how, for a time, internally, and I remember this on the lot, and maybe I'm branching too many subjects here, but I do remember leaving audience behind, going back to production for a second. I do remember how DS9 was going to be syndicated like Next Generation, which, you know, Next Gen had pioneered and had a lot of competition now. Xena and Hercules were, if not there, they were just around the corner. Babylon 5, of course, was going to be famously, you know, the controversy about that and being similar. But I remember it's almost like the old, you know, the first kid pioneers and paves the way, and then everything is given to the second kid, you know, and it's the bright, shiny, everything is all new and wonderful for DS9. And there was a time when, even though Next Gen was still pulling in the ratings and the attention, in the moment in production on the lot, DS9 was, you know, things were being set up on TNG to help. I mean, you want to launch your new show, but even than just like having crossovers early, having, you know, Bashir on DS9, on Next Generation that launched the Worf two-parter.
Right.
But even apart from that, financially and budget-wise, we were laughing online somewhere about the back end of the runabout being built for Timescape.
Oh, yeah. You know, designed. We've talked about that on here before.
Yeah,
talked about that.
And then they never used it on, I mean, it was there, it was designed, they had the pieces, but then they never showed the back end of a runabout on DS9, which is, you know, kind of fun.
Right.
But I can remember this kind of, there was almost a rivalry. And even though now we look back and think, well, Next Gen was obviously the decorated, storied, older child, they wound up 7th season getting an Emmy nomination, right, for dramatic series, which no one could have envisioned the first season, sci-fi and syndicated and all that. But in the moment when DS9 was first going on the stages and being filmed, and their pilot was so huge, and they had all those extras and all those aliens, and Mike Westmore and the crew were like pulling their hair out to come up with all these, you know, new aliens and populate the promenade. The promenade was this amazing new set like nobody had ever done in Star Trek before, barely even for a movie. And all this bright, shiny stuff and money, you know, the pilot for DS9, they went way over budget. And that's why they, you know, pulled back budget the first few shows and got so claustrophobic that Michael Piller, you know, decried later on, wish they hadn't worked out that way. But the first episodes of DS9, the pilot and the development, were getting so much attention and so much attention and money and resources that it seems bizarre now. But Next Generation, like the cast and the crew were like, well, we've just, what are we, chop liver? It's like they were actually thinking they'd been forgotten about. And I specifically remember Marina talking about when they were filming Starship Mine, right? The terrorists on Arcaria base. And it's actually,
I remember it as Picard's horse saddle episode.
The horse, yes. Yes, and Tim Ross is yet another not Tuvok.
Exactly. Another not
terrorist.
Tuvok.
Yeah. This was all these pre-9/11 shows when terrorists were these kind of, wacky doodle dramatic characters. And Americans didn't really have but
yeah,
they had the reception with Hutch Hutchinson, who was the Gabby, right? And I remember, so if you watch that scene now, it was a reception for their crew. Well, the reception is Hutchinson, the 5 or 6 Next Gen crew officers, and two waiters, one of whom is the terrorist that takes him. Like, there's no one else in the scene. And Marino was talking, it's like, we couldn't even get like five or six extras. They were siphoning all of our extras. Our extras money was going to DS9 to put more aliens on the promenade. Now,
yeah, all those extras were hanging out at Quark's.
That's right.
Because they knew, don't go to a Hutchinson party.
Well, don't get caught up in that, in the beam. But it was, you know, and not really, but it was, they were doing bookkeeping. It was like, this, we're just going to like borrow this money. I mean, it's not like nobody was embezzling money, but they really were borrowing a little bit to what they could. And like we said, designing the back end of the runabout on Timescape. But there was actually there was about a year there where before it premiered and right after it premiered, when there was a perception that DS9 was so totally this show on the ascendance. And Next Gen was like, oh, stop complaining, Next Gen. You're so hot and you're so big. You're going to go into movies. So, you know, shut up. let the older brother loan the little brother who's going to be the star athlete or the star scholar here in, you know, behind a couple of years behind you. Can you just let them borrow a little bit here so we get them launched the right way? But I remember there was some resentment, a little bit of resentment around the lots, but maybe, you know, like, oh, those crazy actors. But there was that feeling. And then the show premiered and they had huge ratings. And then it didn't explode. As the first season went along, even though it was on a lot of different stations, we can talk about that too. But as the year went along, the ratings didn't just take Next Gen and then add a shiny 10% new factor. Or whatever. And by the end of the season, they were diagnosing it as, you know, Michael Piller said, well, we blew all our money. We had this huge pilot. We spent the rest of the year trying to make up the money.
Yeah.
And then, and it showed. It showed. We didn't get to add the scope. And that's what added, we kid about it, but that's what really also added to the whole, it doesn't go anywhere. Forget the fact it was tiny runabouts. They really didn't. Everything was station-centric. But that was the point of the show, but they knew that they had that wormhole to get out to things, and that's why they opened the second season with that three-part, you know, Bajoran bit and all that.
But in retrospect, now that we're at the 25th anniversary and we look back, I would argue that blowing all the budget on Emissary and making that episode as grandiose as it was is probably a good thing, because I feel that Emissary does a better job than any other Star Trek pilot of setting up the series. And it establishes Sisko's journey, the start of Sisko's journey. It establishes Bajor's relationship with the Federation and the Cardassians. And it establishes the thread that's going to ultimately run through the entire series, even though we don't really get that much in season one. When you look back from the end of the series and you connect what you leave behind with Emissary, even though season one maybe in the moment didn't work out quite the way that they wanted, I think they did the right thing in putting so many eggs into that Emissary basket. Because now when you watch the series as a whole, it's very cohesive. Mm-hmm. Like TNG, the way All Good Things connects with Encounter at Farpoint was sort of lucky chance and a clever idea at the end of the series for the writers. But it was never set up for that. Whereas Deep Space Nine feels like it was set up from the beginning. Not that they knew exactly how it was going to end, but the setup was there for them just to hook back into.
Well, if you want to compare that, Next Generation's biggest task was just existing.
Yeah, early on. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, Next Generation's, the whole point Next Generation was proving that you could catch lightning in a bottle again. That the new Star Trek, that's what Next Generation was half the time. Oh, have you seen the new Star Trek? The new Star Trek.
Well, that's what it's called in Japanese, Larry, actually. It is Shin Star Trek. It is new Star Trek.
Okay, there you go.
Yeah.
And that was, I don't think it was one of the formal, you know, when they had 47 names on Bob Justman's memos, they were trying to come up with a title. Something close to that was actually one of them. But aside from a title, it was just getting people used to the idea that Star Trek did not have to be Kirk, Spock, McCoy, either watching them get older or recast. You know, it wasn't a zero-sum binary choice here, that there was some other way you could go with the franchise. that the franchise was more than these guys. The franchise was this universe. And of course, now we talk about world building in the you know, Marvel's universe and the DC universe, and it's a given thing. But Star Trek was pioneering that. And not that that comic books didn't have universes on paper. I'm not saying that. But cinematically, and certainly out of a TV show, and certainly out of what do you do after 25 years of a legendary show? Does it die when the cast dies? Here's how you know, it was such a brilliant movie. We've said that many times. But once you've broken open that mold, now what's your next step after Next Gen? So it's like after Next Gen, it's like any reunion show. Half of the first movie or half of anything has to be reuniting the old cast. But once you have done that, now you're free with succeeding series to come up with a new idea, and they're not burdened with that. So DS9 is really the first show that just everybody got to say, okay, this huge Star Trek universe is a thing. We don't have to prove anything to anybody.
Yeah.
So now you can finesse it with tone and location and all that. And your point's very well taken, because I remember, like, I wasn't here. I mean, I watched the pilot for DS9 at back home in Oklahoma before we moved. Voyager's pilot, we had moved to LA. We were here. We were caught up in, you know, on the lot and everything going on here. And I remember thinking that I was even more impressed with Voyager's pilot at the time. Maybe that was proximity. Maybe that was just being excited because I had seen it being developed behind the scenes. But I remember being more excited about it even than DS9's. Not to knock DS9's. I thought DS9 had a huge, at the time I saw its pilot, I remember thinking, oh my God, this blows Farpoint away. Because it had the scope, a wormhole, and this whole nonlinear prophets thing, and this clunky station, and all these daring things they were doing. And oh my God, look at all these aliens, and I wonder if they've got names for all those aliens yet. And, you know, all of that. And are they
would
really
have if they were making action figures like Star Wars.
Yeah, well. Or if they were like scanning. Yeah, right, right. But, yeah. You know, and are they really going to do a show where the decor isn't Starfleet? This is so ballsy. This is so gutsy. And then thinking, watching the Voyager pilot, the crew screening, this is amazing. To me at the time, this even blows away the DS9. Now, you know, Planet with No Water aside, this even blows away Emissary on DS9. But unlike DS9, the whole thing, oh, we're a network show. That was the downfall of Voyager in a lot of ways, or out of the gate, because they had to start compromising and they had to water things down and dilute so much of the power. And the eggs in the basket of the pilot on Emissary, that should be what a pilot is. A pilot should be full of building blocks that the writers can take and run with. And sometimes you throw 10 or 12 or 15 elements into a pilot, maybe you try two or three of them and they don't go anywhere. And you go, okay, well, we've still got 8 or 10 over here we can still play with. And that's the idea of a pilot, is you throw enough elements in there for the writers to play with and take off. And maybe some things don't work out, or maybe you try them and they end quickly and some things become a genius thing. And, you know, the Voyager's pilot had the same thing, relationships, concepts. They just backed away. That was what was so disappointing to me about Voyager at the beginning, was that they backed away from so much of the friction, the whole Maquis Starfleet thing.
Yeah,
and
DS9, exactly.
The difference of that was, and then Enterprise pretty much, it had a pilot that had a lot of elements and they pretty much built on theirs. I just think they had pressure to go faster than they should have. So but my point is, all of these series, it's really interesting. They're all different in their tone. And the thing that's brilliant about DS9, TNG didn't have this opportunity. I think they were just trying to get a damn Star Trek going, and that was what their focus was. And the production, that was not the well-oiled machine, as we know. They took 2 or 3 years to get all that. But DS9 was in the sweet spot of not having to pioneer that. And I think DS9 was the one that, of all the eggs in its pilot basket, was the one that, I mean, it didn't waste anything. Almost every, what was in the pilot of DS9 that didn't get built upon later on? And nothing was backed away from. Nothing was watered down. It was great gun. I mean, every little thread, the Bajoran Cardassian Federation triangle and the friction. I mean, my God, by the time it got to In the Hands of the Prophets and you get into the whole conservative Bajoran religion, you know, butting heads with the secular Federation and all of that. And, you know, the Bajoran thread is off and running in a way that about the time you're feeling sympathetic for, you know, the recovering terrorists turned freedom fighters getting used to peace that Kira symbolizes, you've got this whole other thread to their existence. And, we, you know, and my God, the Dominion is just a twinkle in somebody's eye. In fact, when they started, you know, Michael's advice or his thought that he said many times was, we get, you know, 7 years, the finale, we'll figure out who Odo's people are. And that'll be the big reveal of the finale. And yeah. Until they, you know, he and Ira made the decision to, why don't we throw it out and get there faster?
Yeah. And yet they drop so many hints about the Dominion throughout season two before we ever meet them.
That's when they, into season two is when they decided to do that. Right.
Yeah. But they're hints that you don't pay any attention to a first time through. But then when you go back, you're like, wow, there and there and there and there and there, all of these clues that this is coming up.
What's amazing is you watch the way they teased and dropped, you know, somebody, and it'll be like somebody like Quark will say, or a random alien will say, oh, I don't know, we picked this up from the Dominion, and somebody goes, oh, and it's just a mention, right? And those pile up and pile, or you meet an intermediate in Glatu. I just remember that you meet those intermediary people before you finally get the reveal at the end. So in the same way, to show how things seem to, the way we wound up kind of thinking of DS9 at the time is I remember by the third season and Voyager, it's like DS9 did not have its time in the sun. It's like Next Generation had 5 years, got huge. Yes, you'll have a movie. That's in the plan. Congratulations. You built an audience. You've revolutionized sci-fi. You've revolutionized syndication. You've revived a franchise, showed the way forward. Good on you, TNG. Here's your bright, shining offspring, DS9. And then within 2 years, they went from, hey, DS9 is stealing our money for extras, to, oh, Voyager's coming now, and we're the shiny, bright new network show, and you crappy little syndicated show that crawl for your crumbs of ratings and attention and promotion, and you're not even showing up in the Nielsens, and we're your flagship of a new network. And that was the impetus. And, you know, Rick's attention and Jerry's and Michael's all went to Voyager. You know, we talked the saga about, you know, what happened. But the fact that DS9 went from being the star child to the forgotten middle kid is just amazing too. So, and we know how it turned out. It was like, that could have been the best thing that happened to the series.
Well, that's what I was about to ask you. Would you agree with me that it's actually fortunate for DS9 that everyone's attention got diverted over to Voyager, because it allowed Ira and Ronald and the team to just write really good stories without having anyone in the executive suite trying to say, well, no, you got to do this and you can't do that because so-and-so will get upset about it. It's just, let's just let them write and we're going to go worry about Voyager. I think that's the best thing that could have happened.
Yeah. And this isn't even about Rick, because by the time of Voyager, they were dealing with UPN, and UPN's famously, I say, you know, tin-plated dictator suits with delusions of godhood because their administration turned over so fast. And it's sad because, like, the non-Trek series on Voyager, they had some really pigsty.
Platypus Man.
Platypus Man, right. Those first sitcoms. But some of their one-hour dramas, 7 days, one-hour dramas weren't bad. Now, Marker, Gates' big post, Next Gen. But some of their one-hour dramas weren't bad. But it's like every year they would cancel things because they didn't turn into an instant hit and propel, you know, the number six network into being bigger than CBS or Fox or something. And every year they would cancel these shows, and just, it was like a descending cycle. You know, they were just circling downward. They would never could pull. It's like, oh, in 3 years hindsight, we should have kept that series from 3 years ago and built it. But so Voyager stayed the only thing. And so they were turning over people all the time. And Rick and the Star Trek administration were dealing with getting notes from network people who thought they should be giving notes, and they weren't really great. And the Next Generation, all the energy behind it as being this foundational grounding stone, and not, you know, what Gene wanted. Gene did not want a network sending notes like NBC had done with the original series. That was one of his caveats. Yeah, and going syndicated, they got away from that. And it's almost like after 3 or 4 or 5 years, they were spoiled with that. And of course, DS9 was going to be the same way. And then within 2 years, they're back to Voyager. So part of this being left alone, it's, we talk about like Rick throwing up his hands and letting the crazies at DS9 have their way. Part of it was also still that Rick and the Voyager team were dealing with UPN, and we're not even to the crazy Enterprise, can you put a rock band in the mess hall era.
Well, I was going to say, at least no one ever recommended that a boy band perform in Quarks, right? Because right. That's what would have happened
right.
if DS9 had
Can
been
we at
on
least
MCM.
Make them an alien band? No, we've got to sell magazine covers. No.
No, they're a human band. They're not based on the station. I know you don't go anywhere, but somehow we're going to pick them up. They're going to perform.
It's the human boy band tour coming through. So my point is,
they don't have their own ship. They can't get there on their own. Cisco's got to go pick them up in the Defiant.
Yeah. My point is that in the old paradigm of how TV worked, and you know, Discovery is in a whole new realm here with the streaming service, but CBS All Access kind of, you know, reinventing how that works internally as well. But in those days of the syndicated shows and then the little network shows, as Trek moved along, DS9 got the niche of being the last great. We don't have a network bringing, because the only oversight above Rick was the internal Paramount television studio oversight.
Yeah.
And they were basically, hey guys, don't screw it up, you know, and right. occasionally I've got to, you know, how about you put a show around Scott Bakula? You know, that was Kerry McCluggage suggest. I mean, you know, it was nowhere near that whole level of network people trying to show they deserve their job by sending notes and trying, you know, that whole little that's been there since the dawn of television, people trying to, you know, prove their job and have, and a network having, you know, 20 or 30 series that they're doing that to, and little networks having fewer shows. All of that was not there. So DS9 did have not just a, it wasn't just a dynamic about Rick being distracted with Voyager. It was also the fact that they didn't have that. They were the last time that there was not a tier above them throwing stuff at them, being crazy. So,
right. So
that was also a blessing. And they got to figure out their own way. And then Michael being there at the beginning, going to Voyager, wanting to, you know, being, knowing that Ira had been burned by the third season of Next Gen, and carefully saying, here's Michael trying to build his career. And like Gene did in the 60s, the way to having financial security and being hailed as a hero in media is to develop a show, get it going, get your name on it, get your percentage, move on, get a new show. It's like kind of like a farmer in the 1800s needs to have 8 kids, you know? And here's Michael moving on to start Voyager and then other things and do another deal and handing off to somebody that he can trust to keep the show running and saying, hey, you hated what happened with Next Gen. Here's your chance to go darker, grittier, develop a, you know, out there show. This was supposed to be the out there show compared to Next Gen, and it sure.
Well, speaking of that, what is your view of Rick Berman and Michael Piller as co-creators of this show? Because Deep Space Nine, in one way, maintains that Star Trek thread from the Next Generation, and Gene had trusted Rick with the vision for the franchise. At the same time, DS9 tackles bigger issues and does it in a way that Star Trek had previously shied away from. So what do you see as Rick's contribution and Michael's contribution to the creation and then ultimately the direction that DS9 went in?
Wow. Well, I mean,
like as different creative minds.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I've thought about this. I'd love to sit down with Rick and talk about this because there was this meme about, like I said, Rick threw up his hands and just let Ira and the guys run with the crazy DS9 show while they focused on Voyager. There's been a little pushback to that where Rick is like, and Rick was such a control freak would be an unkind phrase, but it all stems from the fact that it was like, it's like Gene's not on his deathbed, but it's kind of like Gene is like, as the 2 and 3 and 4 years go by from the beginning of Next Gen till Gene passes away. And the last year he was having the mini strokes. It really was a Rick knew, we talk about Rick's motivations, but the bottom line here is that Rick did not want to be, we laugh about this with future people too, future showrunners, for people handling Trek. Rick did not want to be the guy to screw up Star Trek for all time, right? If he's the first baton pass off from Gene, he does not want to be that guy. And so if Rick is guilty of any kind of excessive, what, you know, call him a control freak or whatever, but he, you know, he worked his butt off. You talk to anybody on that crew from production through, especially through the notes, through the passes, the post-production sits and notes on sound and on editing and all of that in Rick's notes. And with two shows going on, he's doing that. He starts to hand it off as the years go by. But he is so involved in the look and feel of the show. And some would say that he needed to, you know, let, the, especially on the front end with the story end, that he needed to let the reins up a little bit. But he was so concerned, he did not want to be the guy to screw up Star Trek. He didn't want to screw it up for the studio. He didn't want to screw it up for the fans. He didn't want to screw it up for Gene's legacy. And he sure didn't want to screw it up for his own reputation. It's like, you're handed this golden goose, and you're the guy that messes it up. So if anything, if he gets blamed for that, that's what's motivating him. And so good job on that, because we almost, you know, as we've seen with movies and all the debate about Discovery, you know, nothing is for sure in television. Nothing is for sure in entertainment when it's a committee, when there's money involved, when there are bean counters and all these factors that are affecting the flow. And until somebody with clout can assert themselves, you're prone to all kinds of, you know, eddies and winds. And for someone to have maintained that kind of protection for his people and protection for his product, that's, you know, we need to go back and kind of look again at how amazing that was that Rick was able to do that for so long. And of course, the downside of the other side of the coin is that as start as Next Gen and then all the shows got so successful, they begat competitors. And at one point, you know, when Next Gen is in Daily Strip reruns and DS9 is out there and Voyager's out there, that it's competing with itself almost, you know. But all of that's in play. And going back to what Mike and Rick did, the pendulum theory. It's where were you when it was time to do a new show? What was the thinking? And we may say the first year of DS9 is TNG light, or it's trying to find itself. But by the time you get to Duet, and by the time you get to Into the Hands of the Prophets, those seeds, maybe they were throwing a lot of stuff on the wall to see what would stick. I'm mixing metaphors badly. But they were there, and they were there to play with. And yeah, it takes Star Trek series as a complex bunch of moving parts conceptually and physically, but everything that came when Ira, you know, took over was there at the beginning. And so what Rick and Mike came up with is what they ran with.
But so you're basically saying that Rick was making sure that DS9 didn't stray too far from the successful formula of the Next Generation, while Michael was perhaps championing a few newer ideas or different directions, like Star Trek can tackle this kind of thing. Here we could do it.
No, I think Rick would as the head honcho, I think Rick would normally be a little more conservative, but I think they're both
That's what I'm getting at.
I think they were both savvy enough media people, entertainment developers, to know, like I said, that it's got to be exactly the same but different. So it's always that tension line of how different and how the same, and what is the same and what is different. And having it, you know, your makeup budget be five times bigger than it was on Next Generation because you're having to populate with it. You know, and how do you write stories and craft in a practical way? You built these insane, crazy sets, the Promenade, the biggest set in Hollywood. You know, when they do the tours at Paramount and say it's the biggest set ever made, standing set ever made for television. 145 feet long, I think, 144 feet long, I used to know it. You know, those kinds of things, they made the huge investment. Another reason why the pilot went over budget. But they had that to play with for all that time. And then the fact that they actually squeeze a home, they wind up, by the third season, they realize what the show is needing, and they bring the Defiant in, and then the Klingons come in the fourth season. And who would have predicted that pulling a character out of Next Gen, like, that is so jumping the shark. But then it works so well. And who would have thought that, you know, Terry and Michael, you know, Dax and Worf's chemistry was going to take off? Those are just like, are they lucky accidents or whatever? So all those things that happened down the line.
I think some of it is the framework of the show, because if you look when Lwaxana is on DS9, for me, those episodes are so much better. That her character just comes to life within that environment and with that writing.
She is so beyond her original joke, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. She's a wonderful character on DS9.
And that was one of the things they, you look at the early, like I was showing you the early documents from DS9, they had that whole Odo, the whole Odo Lwaxana chase at the beginning. They played it a little bit for uncomfortability, but it became so poignant when they're trapped in the turbo lift together.
That's one of the great scenes in DS9, yeah.
and it kind of overlapped with where her character was going at the end of Next Gen 2, those overlapping couple of seasons. But still, what Majel was able to do with that character and the way they were able to write for it, it just made everybody look good. Mm-hmm. It just was good for this. But again, all bringing people over from having a sister show at the same concurrent time frame, you know, where I would have liked to have explored another character, another corner of the timeline. I don't mean alternate. I mean just another time in Trek history. Yeah. And money was going to make them know. Even though you say money, they weren't, you know, they had Starfleet parts, but they created this Cardassian look and built that whole huge station as a stand and made everybody love it.
Well, Larry, you know, one thing DS9 knew you could do is if you spend a lot of money on a set like that, you can always reuse it in the Mirror Universe.
Wow, Chris. I wish they'd done that. Why didn't they do that? No. Yeah, that was, again, and the thing about DS9, aside from having fanboys like Ira and Ron and Renee and all of them all down the line, was that the other hoop that Next Generation jumped through was this whole, we have to prove our own identity, you know, which they backed away from by the time that you have Sarek and you start talking about Spock and all of that. But the first couple of years was a survival mode of creating an identity, again, that was the same but different. DS9 didn't have to live through that, and they could immediately take advantage of all those bits and pieces and fun bits. And you know, it's like even when, as much as they were spending on aliens and all that, even when, like, Rick was still, you know, against using Andorians because he thought they were bug-eyed monsters and all that bit, and there was still, at the time, you know, before the original series became retro cool by the late 90s, before it was retro cool, it was, oh my God, the crazy original series with the Christmas lights and the plywood sets. And the fanboys who were only then starting to win the revolution, but still had a whole generation of savvy, you know, media people still in place from Rick on down, who weren't just in love with blue-skinned Andorians and pig-faced Tellarites. When they weren't allowed to do those races, they would still drop in Tholians and Andorians and tell, you know, DS9, like Ron and Ira were doing their best to drop little original series mentions in. And when they would have baseball on Pike City and, you know, on Cestus 3 and all those little things that they would do, the actual fans, original series fans who were still watching DS9 who hadn't turned it off because it wasn't Next Gen and were able to find it on their local schedule at 3 in the morning and DVR it. Or excuse me, they would VCR it, not DVR it.
VCR,
yes.
Yeah. Tape it.
You know, man. You appreciated those crumbs, and that was another thing. They were able to go back to that original series until they could do Tribulations, which was the icing on the cake, and then they, you know, finally outtopped Voyager on that. But
yeah.
Anyway, we're getting into the thing. By the time they hit their stride and they had enough confidence in their own universe, their own mini universe of what was going on, by the time the Dominion developed, by the time the Ferengi stories were a thing, by the time the Bajoran Cardassian, you know, melodrama, that was the Maquis, that whole arc, and all those arcs going on DS9. And in the middle of all that, they still had time for, like I said, on the other side of the room, Little Green Men, and even the Bar Association, and Our Man Bashir, and the really sheer. Once a year, the wacky doodle fun, and then again, Tribulations being the topper of all of them, those really fun special shows that were out of the box, different, and Iron Man Bashir even doing the transporter accident right.
Oh yeah, right.
We had the patterns, we just don't have room for them. That's right. Yeah, and I'll say this: so I had the chance to do a special interview with Ira, where for once he was interviewing me. And if you keep up with what's going on with DS9 after the fact, you may do this. So I'm not going to tease it too much. But I was able to surprise Ira with a observation. But on the shoe on the other foot, Ira was he was trying to find facts to fit a narrative that DS9 did not get any respect at the time. Because the other side of this whole point is, and I've said this for years, you've said it for years, and I've watched it happen at conventions. We have the numbers, and I think a lot of it's why Discovery has happened, is the huge turnaround in appreciation and perception and respect for DS9, like Ira predicted. Just we didn't exactly know how it would happen, but with the streaming revolution, how everyone, how so many new people have come to, DS9 is more popular now than it was when it was ever on in first run.
Oh,
and there's
by far.
So many more, yeah. And not only more eyeballs are on it, but the respect that it's gotten since television, the landscape of television has come around to its kind of storytelling. But Ira going back to when it was in first run and pressing me and others to say, admit it. You really didn't enjoy DS9 when it was on at the beginning because it wasn't a Starship show. And I was honest and I said, no, it was another, I've said this too, it was another book on the shelf. It was another volume in the Star Trek little E encyclopedia. And it was churning out, you know, Klingon, Cardassian, Bajoran, Romulan stuff and Starfleet. And it was just as much as anything. And then it got even cooler as the years went by. No, I was very much there. I was treated, you know, it and Voyager were equal. In fact, I was even knowing, as disappointed as I was the way Voyager was evolving, only because I thought it wasn't living up to its potential.
Right.
I was, you know, I was thrilled to see, and I thought DS9 was doing the more fun, like I just said, was doing the more fun shows. And, you know, I'm sorry, Tribulation's mic drop. So even though they weren't mainstream, yeah, DS9, you know, storytelling in the milieu of DS9, that no, you didn't have to bribe me to watch DS9 every week. And it wasn't just a matter of, oh, I'm working in this, I have to keep up with the show. It was a lot of fun to watch DS9, even if I hadn't known. So that's an interesting perspective that people now are going back to, that Ira had in his head, that I think he was just feeling under the gun more at the time. I agreed with him though when he said we have the middle child syndrome. We don't get the respect we're due now. We will someday.
Well, Larry, this ties into a final point that I wanted to ask you about because I'm curious how different people view this. So Ira's telling you that they felt like fans weren't really into the show at the time. But of course, now I think we all agree that DS9 is far more popular. And a lot of people are discovering it. A lot of Star Trek fans who wrote it off originally are now watching it on Netflix and Hulu and Amazon or wherever they get it. And a lot of people who aren't even Star Trek fans are finding Deep Space Nine on these services and binge watching it because of all the Star Trek series. This is the one that really is designed for the modern viewing habit of binge watching. And what we're all finding is that DS9 is very relevant to the world that we live in today. Of all the Star Trek series, the story that they tell, it seems that whether you watch it when it aired or a decade later or now 2.5 decades later, you feel like they're talking about the things going on around us. So why do you personally feel that DS9 is standing the test of time as well as it is?
I don't know. I think somewhere, if we go at our famous pendulum theory from a different angle, because the original series hit as what it was, the first impetus to doing a comeback to it was to, you know, you ape that format, basically a ship with crew going somewhere. And in the process of needing to be, again, the same but different, you hit upon a format, because the slap that we laugh about now, about it's the ship that didn't go, it's the show that doesn't go anywhere, not just because they have little runabouts instead of a big starship out of the gate, but because they set up a station. Rick and Mike famously said, well, what you're going to do, a space show, you're either on a ship or you're on a planet or you're on a station. I mean, what are you going to do? Like, it's, you know, it was going to be too, a planet was going to be a lot of live sets outdoors. That was too unwieldy. So if you're not repeating the ship, then you're on a station. And now you're off and running. And just that simple necessity of going with that mindset, I don't think anyone anticipated. You have the undesirable outcomes and then the unintended outcomes. But the good ones about this are you wound up with that huge recurring cast.
Yeah.
And the show that didn't go anywhere meant that, and it, between it being a wormhole where people come to us and being at the crux between two planets that had this history, and by it being on the border that Bashir loved so much at the beginning, the frontier. I mean, you have all of those pieces involved, and you haven't even developed what's going to, you know, the wormhole at first is about us going through it to explore, before they come up with the genius of having the thing out, the other coming toward us. It's that whole bit about Gene saying, oh, no, the future is not about intelligent aliens coming to us to enslave us or eat us. Because if you're a spacefaring civilization, you obviously have survived long enough to get over all that. Like, we apparently survived all our problems to be able to go out into space. So the bug-eyed monster alien invasion trope shouldn't happen if we're talking about true spacefaring civilizations, unless, of course, they're Romulans or Klingons or Borg. But the other way around, it's almost like having the enemy come through. It's like you were able to go back to the alien invasion in such an artful, great, you know, three-level way with the Dominion and all that they wound up developing for that. But the wormhole was the device that let the alien invasion happen, and you play that out for 4 or 5 years. I don't know. I'm just saying that that the things they set up intentionally and unintentionally when they abandon the crew on a ship going from planet to planet is what gave, you know, what made DS9 so different. It's what gave the impetus. I mean, to fulfill that promise and that format, they had to develop the way they did. Looking back in hindsight, it all seemed like it was all predetermined, and obviously it wasn't. But right. when you have the motive, when the motivating forces are space station, people come to us, we've set up this wormhole bringing mysteries, I mean, something exciting was going to develop. Now, but somewhere between Michael and Ira and everyone who came, you know, Pete Fields that first year, I'm leaving some folks out, sorry. And then by the time the team got, you know, by the time Renee and Ron came over when Next Gen was finished, it's all those crumbs still had to be pushed forward. This cast that Mike and Rick came up with and developed first, all these add-on characters that evolved along the way, some of them coming over from Next Generation, you know. It was just a real, I think it's almost like the mix was, it's almost like if you're in a kitchen that had 6 ingredients and they were all really popular things, that's great. But if you had a kitchen that had a full spice rack, you know, you were just bound to have, and you were allowed to go and use all that. You were allowed to use all those tools and those ingredients. Then that's what you're bound to come. You're bound to have a bigger buffet and a bigger international, a bigger multi-ethnic gourmet buffet of outcomes than you would have if you, you know, that's the great thing about busting out of, again, every Star Trek has to find that balance between the same old thing, but in a new way. And when you really push DS9, until Discovery, DS9 was the show that pushed at the back, you know, Enterprise, I mean, Voyager was crew on a ship, different location, same time, different location. Enterprise is crew on a ship who doesn't know what the hell they're doing 200 years ago. No, I mean, you know, they're pioneering.
No, I just love the way you say it, because I always think, like, Voyager is a reaction to DS9 in that we want to go back to the TNG formula, but we have to make it a little bit different, so let's stick them on the other side of the galaxy.
It's almost like a pendulum swing.
Yes, but I love Enterprise is people on a ship that don't know what the hell they're doing. That is a good way.
Which is what I had. Which is what I mean. When I say that, you know what I mean. I mean, they're learning.
I know.
There is no prime.
It's great.
Directed.
I love it. Yeah. But I think one day my people are going to need some sort of prime directive.
Some
to tell them what
some
to do.
Some order. Some directive that will
someone
be of prime importance.
That.
Yeah. Someone might say that. Yeah. Which is what I, you know, like I said, 5th season Next Generation, I was campaigning to do, like, whoever would listen to me, the little writers I would talk. It wasn't like having audiences with Rick, but if I could grab Renee's ear or Ron's ear and say, do a show that's at the founding of the Federation, please. And you could have everybody make mistakes and not be perfect, but they'll be heroic while they do it. Oh, if I could only prove that in case and did an arbitration.
But, and eventually, Larry, they did a show just before the founding of the Federation and then stopped before.
Right.
We got to the founding of the Federation.
Right, right. Yeah. But DS9, it's just amazing. It was, by the end, the show that was darker and grittier wound up having so much heart and so much to be on the lot at the end. Oh, I know what I was going to say. It's... Whenever we talk about an anniversary of a show, it's almost unfair because the focus tends to fall all on the R&D you know, and the pilot.
Yeah.
And we don't think about the whole, because then we have an anniversary for the finale. And no one ever does, this is the 25th anniversary of the fourth season of show.
Well, we should start doing that, on our podcast.
Because we need more anniversary special feature, you know, theme shows.
We really don't have enough.
We don't have enough.
It's very true.
But it's true that when we have these moments, we always focus on the pilots and the, you know, but we always laugh about how Star Trek shows never get, you never settle in or get good until the third season or so. And someday I'll talk about my theory about Discovery's doing the same thing, only just on a compressed schedule, but you know, reach their potential. But that's
episodes would seem like seasons. By the book.
Excuse me. What did I do with my apple? I had it here somewhere. Where's that Kefirian apple? Yeah. Exactly. But DS9 is a perfect example of that. But I can totally remember watching Duet and being blown away.
Yeah.
When I was having to catch it at 2 a.m. on my little Fox station back home before him, and thinking, wow. And that was just the two of them. That was a character and a guest star. And it was Harris Yulin, who was a great actor. But like, wow. That's what they have to aspire to. And I'm trying to remember. See, I know I was impressed by The Measure of the Man, although I remember I was traveling that when The Measure of a Man aired. This is so granular. I was driving from Oklahoma City to Houston to see one of my old friends. And when I got there, it was Houston's night to have The Next Generation. And I got there after it aired. So like, I never saw it for, you know, I always saw it as a tape thing later. And it was always kind of, and I even said that I always got the title mixed up between Measure of the Man and Measure of a Man for years. Mm-hmm. But there were obviously great shows. I remember thinking at the end of the first season of Next Generation, when we got to Conspiracy and we got to The Neutral Zone, I remember thinking, okay, now it's settling in. This is good. I was looking at the writing credits. Tracy Torme and this woman, I've forgotten her name now, they must be the reason why the shows have gotten better. Simplistic little things like that. But I remember and thinking, okay, it's getting there. But not really thinking, wow. Yesterday's Enterprise is when I thought Next Generation has the chance to surpass the movies of the original cast. Like, mm-hmm. They've really hit the stride. I remember thinking that with Duet at the end of the first year of DS9 and locking it in. As impressive as the pilot had been, you know?
Well, and then when the next episode, In the Hands of the Prophets, hit the ball out of the park equally in a different way,
right,
but with the same impact that, wow, you know, they're going to actually talk about some big things here, and they're not going to shy away from addressing issues.
Yes, and In the Hands of the Prophets especially struck me as, hi, we've been showing you like one, it's almost as if we've been showing you one level at a time, because it was a short season, because they started in January.
Yeah.
It was almost as if we'd been focusing on bits and pieces and finding our way, and some things were go to a planet, you know, Battle Lines was, oh, we're in a planet show. And there was a crossover time there where people would come in to pitch, and they would pitch Next Generation, and they didn't quite know DS9, but, you know, Michael would be involved with both shows, and they would pitch for DS9 and go, you know, we could still use this on Next Generation, or it's not quite one of ours yet, or vice versa. But thinking In the Hands of the Prophets was one where it's like, here is the potential. I just think Duet was obviously playing on the Bajoran Cardassian backstory they'd pulled apart, but it was like, oh my God, Nana Visitor is amazing. And when you got that Kira intensity down, here's what you could do with it. And you knew that all that, by then you knew what a great cast they had and how they all could pull that off. When you put the right combination of story and background and actor together. In the Hands of the Prophets was like, the concept is on display. And all, mm-hmm. you know, everybody was doing well. I mean, it was great top to bottom. But it's almost like we're going to pull back. And even though some of these shows have been, we had to, Move Along Home. Oh my God. Move Along Home that we famously, you know, make fun of. But it was so, they cut the budget, like with the 2 weeks to go, they were cutting sets and they were, the script was butchered on to make it fit because of the overrun of the pilot. They were like, they just gotten the report in. Guys, cut 40% out of this show. Oh my God, what are we going to do? Well, all we're spending money on is like no aliens and take it out of the sets. Okay, now madly rewrite. And that's what happens. But by the end of the year, it's like, here's all the pieces. Here's what we can really, you know, and Move Along Home was a, here's something coming out of the wormhole at us, Goofy, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was going to be the twilight zone of the game pieces are affecting our human characters, which was a great idea. But In the Hands of the Prophets really was on track with showing the potential of setting up more to come, but basically utilizing all those pieces. Whereas Duet had been this character study drawing on the background. It was like In the Hands of the Prophets was everything on display. And the goofy Vedic, you know, hats were going to be a thing now.
That's when we met Vedic Wynn.
Yes, so. And Beryl. But the other thing about DS9 that was, as much as Next Gen had started off trying not to be original series and stand on its own, there were, you know, and part of this is not so much Michael, but eventually became the contrariness of Ira a little bit in a funny way. You know, DS9 never had a classic cliffhanger, right? It's like they would do not doing a cliffhanger. That's what Next Gen does. But their final shows would always feel like a cliffhanger, right?
Right. But it's not a part one, part two.
Right. But they, with a definite Mr. Worf fire. I mean, you never had that moment, but they would always end with going, holy crap, right? They would end with this really dramatic, impactful da-da-da moment that was just short of that. And this was like, oh my God, we're going to see the Bajorans and the Federation banging heads, or we reveal the Dominion, although it's really just the Jem'Hadar. We don't know that yet. And, you know, oh my God, the changelings are loose on the station at the end. And no changelings ever killed another. And those years would always end that way. And then even when they would have a two-parter, half the time they wouldn't give it like part one, part two, double titles. They would come up intentionally with two different titles.
Yeah.
But that was another hallmark of that show. And DS9's forging its own identity. It right out of the gate in the first season. So I don't know. Do you think that we famously tell people, oh my God, and there's been pushback on this now. And again, the pendulum is swinging. People famously say, oh my God, the first season of Next Generation is so bad. There's only a couple of shows I would watch. There's only three or four, you know, whatever.
Right. Yeah,
DS9 is not that bad, but there are still some lighter weight. We still are getting our legs finding their way shows. But I don't know. If I tell people to skip over episodes of the first, if they're trying to do a complete rewatch.
I tell people never to skip episodes personally.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
If you're going to rewatch it, watch them all. Because especially with DS9, even in the first season, there's stuff in all the episodes that you kind of need to know. I mean, I still get people ask me like, where'd Sisko get his baseball? I'm like, did you watch If Wishes Were Horses? That's where he got the baseball. And the baseball becomes a character on the show. Mm-hmm. And if you skip over If Wishes Were Horses because you think it's silly for Rumpelstiltskin to be on the station, well, you missed where Sisko got his baseball from. It's an important little piece of information for you to know. And the other thing that I've noticed in season one is they did more character development for Kira in the first season of DS9 than they did certainly up to that point for any female character in Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
And really, to this point, maybe Discovery is different with Burnham because she's the lead, but developing a female character in Star Trek, no one's ever done anything like what they did for Kira.
Mm-hmm.
And it's there in the first season. You don't even need to take the whole series into account. The first season.
And Nana took every bit of it and ran with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. She
everything
brilliant.
They threw at her.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did I ever tell you the story about how they almost called the baseball Livingston?
No.
Oh, okay. I don't think I've heard this one. I guess that's because it didn't exist, but it would have been funny.
Okay. That makes more sense. But you never know. I'm like,
I had you for a second. I wish you all could have seen that.
All right. Well, Larry, we need to wrap up. We are going a bit long, but you know, this is the thing about DS9. I feel like we've only touched on a few points, and yet we've had this great discussion that's gone well over an hour just on DS9 alone.
Well, the amazing thing about DS9 is just how we laugh about the pendulum swings, but amazing to me how the view, I've always defended it, no matter what Ira says, but how the rest of the world has come to see DS9 with the tools they have available, streaming, especially this last 10 years, it's just been amazing about watching the respect now to where people vault it among everything. People will swear up and down it's the, you know, and I don't like to get into because there's factors of time and generation and all kinds of context. But now it's gone from the stepchild to a lot of people's favorite or the most important or most impactful of any Star Trek series ever, right?
Yeah. Well, and I even see people who they might not say, this is my favorite of all the series, but they will say, this is the series that has the best writing, the most thoughtful, and the most complex writing.
This is
the series that did the most with the Star Trek concept.
Right. This is the series that has stood the test of time, or this is the series that stands up the best today, where they're getting into the way media, you know, and who in 10, 15 years, where the media storytelling landscape will be, maybe we'll have a different opinion or whatever. But those are all the accolades that are hitting DS9 now that no one would have ever said.
Predicted.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, exactly. All right.
Well, Ira predicted it, but that was...
But he didn't think you'd believe it.
He didn't think I would believe it. I couldn't believe he thought that I didn't love and respect the show at the time. That was so... I hate to be a meme buster, Ira, but no, I was with you all the way. I will never forget that crew screening I mentioned for the Voyager pilot and came out of the Paramount Theater, and they had like a little, you know, bar and everything. It was a big deal. And they had a little round, you know, tall tables. And Ira was sitting there with his head down. And it was the week that Past Tense aired. And, and on one hand, of course, he was happy for Brannon and Jerry and Michael and Voyager and the network show. But he was just at that point. He really felt like they had busted their butt and done this amazing show. The concept, the Bell Riots, a commentary on how do we get from today to Gene's, you know, utopia. It didn't happen overnight. There were a lot of rough steps along the way. We're actually doing a story about what happened in the middle, and extras and production and backlot and streets and all of that big scope stuff they got to do as a two-parter. And he was so afraid that it was all going to get swept away in the glory of the... because they were airing about the same time. And the glory and the fanfare behind Voyager. Not to knock Voyager at success, but he was just afraid they were going to get completely forgotten and lost in the glare of the spotlight on Voyager. And you know, again, not wishing them ill, but just thinking that all their good work... like, someday, someone's going to pay attention to this. It won't be this week. It won't be when it's on the air. But someday someone's going to see. I hope somebody sees the stuff we're putting, you know, we're pouring our blood, sweat, and tears into to get across to people and do some real Star Trek and some real Gene Roddenberry storytelling. And I would safe to say that at the moment he was feeling a little downtrodden, a little overwhelmed and forgotten.
Yeah.
But as the years have gone by, I think everything's been borne out.
Yeah, it absolutely has.
I mean, I'm dreading 2024, aren't you?
Yeah, although I feel like we're on a path.
That Star Trek is so good. That Star Trek's so good about
we're on a path.
Wait, when we get to World War III? Yeah. Yikes.
All right. Well, it's been a great discussion of DS9, but it's not the only thing we've been talking about here on the network. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Earl Grey.
It's sort of what she did with Picard and just said, I'm looking at the entire expanse of your career decisions and these decisions, you've broken the Prime Directive. And so looking at this mass, it sort of brought it back to Conspiracy, where it's like, yeah, you're going to find something and there may be excuses for it, but what's the pattern overall? I thought was an interesting twist that she did against Picard.
Warp 5.
The reason why I'm surprised by this is because you don't see a lot of asexual reproduction in higher order life forms, because sexual reproduction allows for genetic diversity, whereas, again, asexual reproduction dictates genetically identical individuals.
The 602 Club.
What happened last season and the things that start to happen this season is, you know, Jay comes in and tells them about the danger from... or two with Zoom and everything, you can see the weight that it's having on this person. And I thought that that's just really good writing. Like, you know, that you can't stay that same kind of person that he was in the beginning here. And they're going to do some things throughout the season that are going to help Barry kind of overcome that, or at least try to overcome that. But at the beginning, I really felt like that the writing was very strong, specifically for the character of Barry and everything he'd been through in that first season and now into the second season.
Literary Treks.
Yeah, that's definitely the case, I think, for sure. Well, in this novel, it's very much about the Klingons and their society. And it's from the perspective, there's a framing story, basically, in which Captain Kirk starts reading a book called The Final Reflection, which is told from the perspective of the Klingons. And it's ostensibly the book that we are reading here. This is the book that Kirk's reading in this book.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can find us everywhere you get your podcasts. Of course, we're on Apple Podcasts, in iTunes, Google Play Music. Most of our shows now are in Spotify. You can also find us on Stitcher and TuneIn and Spreaker, third-party apps. Go to our website. You can stream from there. You can download the MP3 files. We have many, many ways for you to get the show. And if you're only familiar with a few of our shows, I highly recommend that you look for the Trek FM Master Feed. The complete Master Feed has every episode of every show that we do. 2 to 4 new episodes of podcasts go into that feed every single day. And it's a really easy way to sample the wide variety of shows. We have about 25, 26 or more. Well, with the Trek Files coming up, what is that? 27 or more podcasts on the network. So check it out and find out what we're talking about all the time. So Larry, if people want to find you, and we talked about the Trek Files, the T-Files in news today, tell us where people should go to find you and also what else you have coming up.
Well, as usual, LarryNemechek.com is the great hub for everything of mine, including Portal47.net, where we deep dive every week. And eventually we will have Discovery folks coming in. And at Larry Nemechek on Twitter. Trekland Tuesdays Live is on Facebook now every week since we haven't done a show a long time together, Chris. And I've been doing that every week now at 1 o'clock on Tuesdays, 4 Eastern in the evenings in Europe. Just 15, 20 minutes of me on camera talking about stuff of the week. And hopefully not the same-o, as always. I try not to just pile on, but do maybe a little bit of dot connecting people aren't used to seeing or thinking about while all the other day's headlines and people are squawking about the latest thing on Discovery, maybe looking at that or something else in a different angle. But yeah, so Larry Nemechek's Trekland on Facebook for that, and Portal 47 on Facebook. And we have a adjacent to Portal 47 called the Portal 47 Observation Lounge, where you can come in and jump in with background, other background fans too, and get the gist of that. But yeah, just good old at Larry Nemechek on Twitter is good.
Awesome. Well, if you'd like to find me, tying into today's show, I wanted to mention, Larry, that Matthew and I recorded an episode of The Orb earlier today.
Well, it's about damn time, Chris.
Yeah, I know. Time zones and schedules are difficult to line up. But this was our chance to talk about the DS9 anniversary, just like you and I have. But of course, we approached it from very different ways. Mm-hmm. So I think people will enjoy hearing the conversation you and I had today. But then go to The Orb, which is our Deep Space Nine podcast, and listen to Matthew and me talk about it. And you mentioned earlier, Larry, when we were talking, how when there's an anniversary, we tend to focus on the pilot. And we maybe don't talk about the big picture of the series as much. I think, well, Matthew and I did talk about the pilot a little bit. But as we tend to do, we did talk about the series as a whole and what it means to us and why we think that it has stood the test of time. So I encourage everyone to check out The Orb if you're not familiar with the show and you love Deep Space Nine. So that's one podcast that I do here on the network. And speaking of trying to connect dots that maybe people aren't thinking about instead of just piling on more of the same, that's what I do on Notes from the Edge, which is a sub-show of The Edge, which is our Discovery podcast. And I do share my thoughts on the episode each week briefly at the beginning, but the primary purpose of that show is to look at connections in Discovery to the greater Star Trek franchise. And so I have been told by people And I feel this way, that it is a bit unique among the various Discovery podcasts that are out there, because I am trying to connect dots that aren't so frequently connected.
Oh, that's,
so that's another show that I have here on the notebook.
That's crazy, Chris, because those writers on Discovery, they don't know anything about, they're not
I know,
fans, they don't know anything about the franchise.
They have no idea what they're doing, and I know that because I have been told that in social media.
Now, where do I put the facetious emoji here now? I was just kidding.
I know, yeah. We need some like audio emoji or something. So, anyway, those are two
Adogies.
Places to find me. Perfect.
Yes.
That'll be an Apple's keynote later this year. You heard it here first. Audogies. They only work on the iPhone X2. Get it in October.
From the other side of the internet. Yes.
Exactly. So yeah, if you want to hear more podcasts from me, those are two places. You can also find my writing about Star Trek on StarTrek.com, and you can find Larry's stuff there too. And if you want to find me on social media, my username on Twitter is C. Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with a Y. And that's also my username on Facebook and pretty much everywhere in social media. I'm most active on Twitter, so that's probably the best place if you really want to chat with me. But you'll also find me in the Babel Conference, which is our listeners group on Facebook for the entire network. There'll be a post there for this episode. And I do interact there in those chat threads that form underneath the posts. And if you want to send me an email, you can do that at trek.fm/contact. Choose to send to a show and choose the Ready Room, and that'll come to me by email. I do want to take a moment and give a shout out to our associate producers here on the Ready Room. Renee Roberts, Zachary Fruling, Sam Piasek, Kay Elizabeth Shaw, Tim Robertson, David Shuford, and Ju Kim. Thank you so much, guys, for your support of the show and your continuing support of the network. We would not be able to publish our podcasts without you. So I thank you very, very much for that. And if you're listening and you're not yet a supporter of the network and you would like to do that, and maybe you'd like to become an associate producer, you can find out everything you need to know if you go to patreon.com. That's patreon.com/trekfm. And we have information there about the roundtable where you can get on mic with other listeners and hosts from the network and talk about Star Trek, and that goes out into the master feed and is also now on the main website. So if you go to the front page or even look in the sidebar, you'll see new cover art for Patrons Roundtable, and you can listen to those discussions. We also have Patron Zone, which is a special website for our patrons, and other perks as well. So you can find out everything if you go to patreon.com/trekfm. So thank you so much to everyone who is supporting us there.
And I want to thank, just go off script a moment, and thank you again, Chris, for hosting the Trek Files on the master feed here at Trek FM also. It's a Roddenberry podcast, but I having it in the family alongside Mission Log Pod. And again, one more time, very excited. Hope everybody goes over on January 23rd and does the drop, gets the document on our Facebook page, the Trek Files, and gives a listen to episode one. Episode one is not a rare document. It's a document any real Star Trek fan should have read by now, but we start there and then proceed deeper into Gene's hidden recesses of his files and drawers.
That sounds great. Tune in and you too can rummage through Gene's drawers.
That's exactly what it is. Yes.
Okay, so everyone, check that out. All right, Larry, well, I am going to wander off and see once again if I can find out how Spock knows that Grady is pregnant.
Will you do that, Chris? Because you know what? It's time to stick a pointy fusion reactor cone from the lower core of the station in it, because the Ready Room is done. But one last point, Chris. Even with 25 years of hindsight, I found myself, I found a major web genre news site whose initials are Nerdist, did an article about major anniversaries of genre productions coming up in 2018. Would you believe, like 20th anniversaries, 10th anniversaries, games, comics, TV, movies, would you believe that Deep Space Nine is not on this list that has, I don't know, 40 or 50 titles on it? Really? The most supposedly, in hindsight, relevant entry of the Star Trek franchise, the way all the modern hipsters view it? And they left DS9 off this list. Sometimes the more things change, the more they stay the same. But what can you say? There you go.